heard two episodes now of Ron Shusett's memories of the making of Alien. So, Harry, what do you think your favorite story is so far?
That's really a hard one, Robin. There's so many great stories, and Ron's such a great storyteller. I think I have to say that the stories of working with a relatively new group of actors who were theater professionals, but they were unknown in the movie biz, and obviously one of those would become a pretty big actress, Sigourney Weaver. So I just love that peek into how things were before they made their big break.
Yeah, and how interesting it was that Ridley kind of gave over that job to Ron, because yeah, he knew he was not good with actors, and Ron took to it like a duck to water. So I always laugh when I think of Ron trekking through the woods in London after a 3-hour subway ride trying to get to Shepperton Studios, because the Fox screenwriters, Giler and Hill, had talked the studio into taking away Ron's transportation money, and then Ridley going ballistic when he found out about it. I also remember the first time I ever went to one of Shusett's famous Halloween parties. There was Ron coming through the room in his costume. He had his usual baggy cardigan, the wool scarf, the flat cap, but he had the alien face hugger rubber prop tied around his head, actually right around his face. And now that I think of it, with each successive movie, there came a different costume.
That must have been a sight to see.
It was.
You know, Robin, we've been getting some interesting feedback on the first and second episodes. People are definitely entertained by Ron's stories, which I guess in retrospect is not too surprising. But right, they're also finding his stories inspirational, how he went toe-to-toe with some of the most powerful forces in Hollywood as an absolute beginner.
Yeah, it took such guts. He was incredibly persistent. And he followed his gut, and you keep hearing him say that. He listened to his instincts, whether it was supporting Giger when the studio said his designs were pornographic.
Or telling Fox execs they needed a Cecil B. DeMille shot.
Yeah, right.
And if they didn't build a space jockey set, that the movie would actually be a flop.
And he said it threw the fear of God into him. And all this when he was aware that his stepping out of line could get him fired. And of course, that was the last thing he wanted. He was walking this fine line between total audaciousness and total humility.
It's interesting. He would initially back down if someone told him, hey, you don't know what you're talking about. You've never done a movie before.
Yeah, he'd admit that they were right and say, oh, yeah, I could be wrong. And then he'd step back and let them stew about it, keep silent until they came around.
And it's funny because he was always actually shocked when his way worked.
Yeah. That dog with a bone behavior resulted in some of the most iconic moments in the movie.
And some of the best scares.
Exactly. So hearing those kind of stories can be inspirational for anybody who is striving, I guess, in whatever field they're pursuing. You know, you got to be bold, confident, you have to speak up, take a stand, but especially take risks.
Yeah, it's truly inspiring. And there's actually another one of those moments coming up here in episode 3. So let's take a listen. Naturally, you were a student of film, and were there any movies that you would think of that were inspiring you in terms of like how or what you wanted to emulate or what reminded you of the mood that you wanted Alien to be?
No, because those movies that were that abstract and bizarre and science fictiony were never done a budget to that. They were always the green slime, the creature beyond space. They didn't use the talent of the designers, genius, that were the best. They didn't use the best directors on sci-fi till then. So I just saw it as I wanted the mood of Jaws, but in outer space, you know.
I wanted to ask you about the adult alien. I guess that goes back to Giger. Can you tell us about the building of that creature and how it was used in the scenes where it came into contact with the actors?
Giger designed all of that. He designed not only the sets, but most of the creatures. Even though there's more, I mean, he designs the creatures and the sets, and he wins an Oscar later. But he worked from his drawings, and that, remember that head that was phallic, sort of? All this came from Giger in his early drawings, and later we said, okay, this looked good. And the tail was operated mechanically, but he had a guy doing the mechanics of the tail. But it was all his design, all Giger's design of it. But they thought the creature was disgusting when they saw it drooling. And I said, well, it's supposed to be. Well, it's going to turn everybody off. That's what they first thought when they saw Giger's version of these things.
What was your first response on seeing the completed creature?
Well, since we had worked on every time we got a draft from or pictures from renderings, we'd have input on it. And we almost, it was like 80% the way we wanted without us saying anything. Each of the creatures he designed, all of them were fantastic. He sent us renderings on them, and so usually color rendering, watercolor. And so he got it on the money, every creature, as he was reading the script and designing each creature.
But when the first time you actually saw it in the flesh, what was your response? I mean,
we weren't like the fox. We weren't sure he could design something that would look that good on screen till we saw the suit and everything. And once we saw it, his design articulated by the people that build it, which he was different than the people who actually build the suit, the mechanics of it, and how he designed the look of it. Once we saw it for the first time, we thought, oh my God, this is going to be incredible, because every other movie that shows a horrible monster, and you don't show much of it, and when you show it, it looks silly because it's a rubber suit. But this was rubber suit, was the most amazing suit I'd ever seen. It was so organic and so convincing. I knew right away, well, it's going to look incredible on screen. Because on stage, even when you knew it's a rubber suit, it scared the shit out of you. It was so powerful and believable.
And also, didn't Ridley do something where he really hardly showed the whole creature at one time for very long?
Right, and he was so right about that. That defeated those people that show too much of it and too early. So you never saw, the first moment you saw it really at all, more than a flash glimpse, was in the tunnel, I think, when it killed Tom Skerritt. And you saw all of a sudden he was holding a flashlight and it blinded you from the camera's eye. And so as soon as he turned it around, the first thing you saw, because it was really dark there, it wasn't just pretend dark, it was sheer dark in this little place. As soon as he turned around, there was a creature right next to him with this horrible, and it just grabbed him and cut. But you didn't know it was there, and it was the first time you saw any clear version of it. He was sitting on his haunches, but you saw it for two beats, and it was there, and it was not a rubber suit. It was a horrible creature, and they cut from it, and it was there, and it just left, I don't know, just left blood or something, and he was gone. He took it away somewhere else. And that scene I had a lot to do with, too, in the final showing of it. Because the two takes we got on it, one was great of the creature's face, but that you couldn't see, you looked like it was, his body wasn't right there. But the other shot was you could see the body was right there next to him. It wasn't inserted from another shot but one shot didn't have both. You either had to choose between that great horrible face, but you didn't really believe or know that the body was substantially right next to him, or the other showed the body was right there, but you couldn't see the face. So they were stuck. We couldn't go reshoot it. We shot it about seven times. And what we got done, we only had those two shots of it. I think I know exactly how you can get the both face and the body. So how? I said, well, you superimpose it. You superimpose the shot of his face over his body. So it's one shot. You got both in. He said, you can't do that, Ron. I said, why? Well, he said, you don't understand. Film is light going through. You can't, it's going to look like, it's going to jump a frame. It's going to look like we jammed something else in there. I said, I don't think it will. What do you mean you don't think it will? Well, what do you know about editing? I said, well, I know this, that most times when you have darkness, because I was in that when they shot part of it. I was out of camera range. I was in that real dark little tunnel. I said, I know in most movies when you want to show darkness, it's simulated darkness, or else the audience would be angry. They'd say, what is this? We can't see anything. So you never have real darkness. This happens to be real darkness. It's pitch black. It won't. You won't see the clip of the click when it goes to another shot. There'll be one. He said, "Well, it doesn't work that way, Ron." I said, "Well, I tell you what. I could be wrong." I said, "Let's do it the way I said. Let's edit it like that, like it's one shot, and let's invite 50 people around the lot that are seeing, making other movies, and sit them down and tell them a few minutes about it, about the scene, and let's see how they react to it." So, okay, we're gonna do that. So they got about 50 people. And when they got to, they told him a little about it, and they got to, and they screamed at the top of their lungs. And they all said, after the lights went on, just the one guy said, "Didn't look like phoning up." "No, what do you mean phoning up? It works perfect." And so, "I can't believe it." And the other said, "I can't believe, how could you know that, Ron?" I said, "I don't know. I'm just too dumb to know it was wrong." And so that was just sheer instinct, especially since I'd never made a movie before then. And then I was so excited that I got one of the biggest scares by forcing him to do something he said wouldn't work. That I used to sit with a chair in the front of the movie theater whenever they do that scene and watch the audience jump back 1,000 heads at once.
How did it feel to see your words written on paper come to life in the mind of other people's imagination and what you saw on the sets?
Since I'd never made a movie, but these people were working with a genius level, Giger, Ridley, they were so brilliant at what they did it so good. If they'd done it pretty good or good, but they did it so magnificently that I thought, oh my God, I was right. I know what I'm talking about. It was like, I was semi-surprised, but you believe in yourself and then finally reality comes and maybe you're not as good as you thought you were. Sometimes you are. So since that was my first movie and everything was working so great and everything I tried to do and convinced them, they did. Because they said, "Ron keeps coming out right. We can't stop believing in him now. We're in too deep. You know, we got to hope he's a genius and not a crackpot." Or the whole movie was spent. Oh, the movie budget went way up. It was supposed to be like $10 million. It went up to $20 million. They were going to do it big budget, but we didn't think $20 million. So at one point, they said, "We got to keep listening to Ron because the movie keeps getting better." And so even though he's never made a movie, he's somehow getting it right. So that's another reason I accidentally got gratification. I remember Ridley's, I was visited by J. Lee Thompson, who was one of the great directors in history. And I had met him socially, and I was trying to do a movie with him before I did my first movie, which was Alien. And I never did anyone, but he visited me on the set. And then he and his wife came, and he said, "Well, Ron, I was right about you. I knew you were going to become a great producer and writer." His wife said, "Well, Ron, checkered sport coat you were wearing looks like an American gangster." You looked at a woman to criticize your fashion. I said, "Well, I am an American gangster. How do you think I got this far?"
So Ripley,
yeah,
everybody else is dead, and Ripley grabs the cat, and she knows she's got to get out of there to get away from the alien. So she goes to the shuttle pod, the escape.
Right, which can fire, blow up the ship, and fly home in that.
Right. And so she thinks when she closes the door behind her, that
the creature's blowing up with a ship.
Right. Then what was your concept?
Then when it happened, it was a basic terrific idea, good, powerful, that he's on the ship with her. And that's one final twist in these modern movies, and that was a good one because you were sure he blew up. But then I said, really, there's a way that it can be 10 times more effective. He said, what? I said, if it's hidden, it's camouflaged, and not just in another room, a closet there. He's there all the time, and suddenly he emerges out of the wall. He's like part of the wall. And Ridley said, you're right. That would be fantastic. He said, oh, okay. But how are we going to get that to happen without them seeing he's in the wall? Instead, in the closet, he could come out of it believably. But how could you not see? He's so weird that he's in part of the wall there. And I said, well, we shoot it every day at the end of shooting. We hide the creature in the wall, we build it around him, and we shoot it that day. And if we can see he's there, it's stupid. It's like Mad Comics. You can see, well, he's right there. But if you can't see him and he suddenly emerges from the wall, it'll be one of the biggest moments. Okay, you're right. So we had this guy, Baggio or something, he was 7 foot tall in the suit. So we said, let him lay down there, and we rebuild the set around him every day and shoot it different. And every time we shot it, you could see him. And we went, oh, my God, this is embarrassing. Every day we shot it at the end of the day. You could never not notice he was there. And one day we had a design, but we wasn't sure any of them would work. okay, we've got this new wall built that's more similar to him, we thought. Let's get him in here. So we said, Baggio, get in here. And he jumps right out of the wall. And we said, oh, shit. You know, we got shot by our own. He's been there all the time. We got it. We got it. Oh, my God. And I would just shoot this the way it is. And it's a secret, which we didn't know till finally that day we had tried it. His head, that phallic kind of head, with there were an air tube, a bottom shaped like that, and one below his head. And his head was right in the middle of it. And you didn't know it was his head because he looked like part of it until he turned it and had a mouth. And once we got that right, it was one of the most fantastic moments, and that was a serendipity. But again, that was a masterpiece of design, both the wall, the creature, Giger's work. All those things had to happen for it. The creature had to be so weird and yet invisible to us when we sat there. And that was something, one of the only few ideas I can think of that I added as we were shooting, and luckily Ridley bought into it.
Tell me a couple of things here. What was it like seeing it in a theater, like there was a screening for an audience for the first time, that experience for you?
Okay, that was momentous. We screened it out of town for the first time. We didn't screen it at the studio. We wanted the audience reaction because it's such a crazy movie. We needed to have real people, not just people who work at the studio and maybe critics there. We needed, it was two places, Texas and what city, I forgot, and Kansas City. We screened it two preview audiences, two different times, for the first time. And the first time, something terrible went wrong. The sound stopped working. One of the soundtracks went out at the first screening, the first time I ever did it live. And so the audience wasn't reacting very well to the movie. And I found out later they couldn't hear half of what was going on. If you look and see visually, but you don't understand the dialogue or any of the plot, you're out of it. And nobody was reacting or screaming or getting scared. So later we looked at the preview cards and couldn't hear, couldn't understand, couldn't follow. The sound went out. We said, oh, well, the sound went out. That's why. So we spent all the next day tuning up the sound for the next screening. Until then, we thought it was going to be a flop because what if it was just an excuse? Maybe the sound didn't work, but maybe the movie just wasn't good enough. So I remember going into the restroom and I said to myself, okay, if this movie isn't great, then I'm going to keep my mouth shut. I'm never going to fight for anything I believe in again because I don't know what I'm talking about. And I said, this has to be brilliant or else I'm going to just be a hanger-on from now on. I made that resolution myself because I thought it was a masterpiece when I saw it alone. They showed it to me. I said, oh, it's working fantastic. So, and then when I came out and the sound worked for the first time, the audience went crazy. The usher fainted in the aisle when he saw the, I guess, Chesper, he went right down. And I guess he was hypoglycemic and they, you know, rushed him out. And it just everything. People were screaming at the top of their lungs and applauding, constant, every cheering, every scare.
After the test screening, wasn't there a screening at the Academy and you were sitting behind Jack Nicholson and Warren Beatty?
Yeah, right, who I'd never met in my life. They were either behind us and they were screaming like kids at a Saturday matinee. I saw that they were behind us. They were just shrieking at every scare at the top of their lungs, and I'd never met them. And later there was an after party and they were invited. So some guy who gave the party says, I want you to meet two people. And it's Nicholson and Beatty. And they say, God, you guys are fantastic. Scared the shit out of us. You know, I was just speechless. I could hardly talk. I said, oh, thanks. Because we didn't know how maybe real pros would think it's stupid. You know, maybe serious actors would think it's stupid for all we know.
For me, I actually remember watching this movie when I was 8 or 9 years old and I was at my aunt's house.
Oh my God, I was always scared. I was upset when little kids under 10 were allowed in. I thought I scarred them for life.
You almost did. What was interesting is that no one else was in the room and the adults were having a party, so they had the kids just watch TV and that came on.
Oh my God.
And because it was dark, because it was the late 70s, so the quality of the TV is not HD, and the movie itself is dark and ominous, I think there was something about the pacing of it, that it's something you were alluding to earlier, how you always wanted to take out the stuff that was too funny or too campy and just really keep it serious and keep the movement going. So I'm wondering if that's something you were conscious of, that you there was a mood you were going for with this.
Well, that was the whole thing. That's what I had to sell Ridley. It's not working the first third because it's you smothered the mood. It's gotten too heavy. If it can't be moved fast paced, if it's too long, if the ad becomes pretentious and funereal, you got to have just the right medium touch. It's got to be as spooky and ominous, but it can't be so you're going, it's happening.
Did you see this more of a horror movie or a science fiction movie, or did you start a new genre?
That's more or less it. Yeah, because when we wrote it, that's what we thought. This is going to be brand new. Nobody's ever seen anything like it. And it's going to be science fiction, but a horror, but more classy and more ominous than any horror movie you've ever seen. But of course, it hadn't been all those people that did it with us. Ridley and Giger and the cast, which are brilliant actors, they didn't look like they were spoofing anything. They were really into it. Ian Holmes, Yaphet, Harry Dean, John Hurt, Tom Skerritt, they were all superb actors, but I got to say, that's why Ridley cast them. And once they got sold, they knew it was probably going to be potentially a big hit. But once it started to spool itself, and they allowed them to see a few scenes just to show them a touch of it, and they went, oh my God, this is fantastic. You know, this is working better than we ever thought it was.
Do you wonder what kind of movie it would be if Roger Corman had made it?
Well, we knew it was going to be a schlock because he did something, Humanoids from the Deep or something. He did some ripoffs later of Alien, and it would be schlock, but he had the vision to realize, like you said, you make it for 20 million, it deserves it. Go ahead, make it better than I would have made it. So that was very admirable.
And Fox, despite the movie's success, was content for it to be a one-off for a while.
Oh,
How is it that James Cameron came to direct its excellent sequel, Aliens?
Yeah, I think he was so powerful that he convinced him to do a sequel of it. And I liked what he did because he decided to make it differentiate because it would be more action-oriented, like a bunch of Marines land. So then it wouldn't be conflicting with what Alien was. It had many similarities to the epic moments, but yet it would be action-paced, which was the opposite of what an action feeling to it. And that was good because that made its own niche, but still got, and all the other sequels failed except his, which is interesting. But he's such a genius, the guy that could do Avatar, is, you know, it's like if Spielberg had done an Alien movie, it'd probably be great. But the directors they had were good, but they weren't good enough to live up to Ridley and Giger's work to equal it. I go, what's the name that Ebert, before he died, wrote a piece, was great. He said, they keep trying to make a movie with similar impact, Alien, not a sequel. And they always fail miserably. You know, they just can't do that, even the non-sequels. They're trying to do something like that, but then none of them have the power or near the impact of that Alien movie, the first Alien movie.
Do you remember what the mood was like as you were wrapping up the final days of shooting on the set? Do you get the sense that either the team working on it, the directors, the actors, you felt like you had created something special?
Everybody did. Everybody was looking at the footage. The studio was amazed with it. They said it's going to be bigger than Star Wars, to their credit. By the time we were in the last phases of shooting, they said, oh, this is going to be huge. They were looking at the footage, and it was all coming together, and it was dragging on because we couldn't quite finish it. It was going way over budget, but the studio didn't flinch. They didn't say, well, we got to stop. We got to again. No, they just kept shooting until Ridley got the ending working on screen the way we had it in mind on the page. And they didn't hesitate at all. They said, well, when do you think you're going to finish? Really said, I don't know. Am I done? Well, it can't be long, but we can't ruin the ending just to get it wrapped up. It'll throw the whole movie. And so, okay, you're right. And they just kept giving us money. No matter how it dragged on or how we weren't quite getting the ending, they didn't flinch. They just kept pouring money into it and had total belief in it. After we finished it, they were trying to decide if it was good as they thought it was, okay? So they only invited two people. Spielberg and Lucas, just those two. Just, what do you think of this movie, guys? You know, I heard this later because I was represented by Lucas's attorney. I got in with him after I did the movie, and his attorney represented me. But I'd never met him. So he said, good news for you. So what? So, well, Fox said, you guys here, Spielberg, Lucas, what do you think of this? So he said, guess what? Spielberg said it's better than Jaws. Lucas said it's better than Star Wars. I said, no. Yeah. I said, they had a reason to, because Spielberg said it's just as scary as Jaws, but by nature, of course, it's more imaginative. So if he said, if you can't, it's better than Jaws. What more can I tell? It was the highest grossing movie, either the second to Star Wars or the highest. And Lucas said, they did something I'm jealous of because I couldn't quite pull it off. I tried to do a serious science fiction THX when I was at Warner's, and it flopped. It was really a good movie, but it was more serious, not a comic book. And then I realized the only way I could do science fiction, which he loved, was to be a comic book movie, but a great comic book. And somehow they did what I wanted to do. Alien was a serious movie. It was never a comic book, but it was just as big a hit. It was did comparably much at the box office.
And of course, you went on later to work with Steven Spielberg in Minority Report.
Right, right. And when I got him, the studio was furious.
Well, that wraps up episode 3 of An Alien in Hollywood. Ron Shusett's memories of the birth of one of the most amazing movies ever made. After its release in 1979, Alien won an Academy Award for Best Visual Effects, a Hugo Award, and 3 Saturn Awards, including Best Science Fiction Film.
It is considered one of the greatest films of all time, and it was deemed, quote, culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant, unquote, by the Library of Congress. And at the premiere of the movie at Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood, some of the models and sets and props were displayed outside to promote it. And some religious zealots set fire to the model of the space jockey, believing it was the work of the devil. In this case, devils, Giger, Scott, O'Bannon, and Shusett are guilty as charged.
It seems like there's no shortage of great stories when it comes to both Ron and this movie.
Yeah.
So make sure you tune in to further episodes of An Alien in Hollywood as Ron talks about navigating the shark-filled waters of filmmaking with Paul Verhoeven's Total Recall and Steven Spielberg's Minority Report. For now, this is Harry Duran
and Robin Maxwell signing off.